it's the misogyny and white supremacy that both empower white nationalists to these acts of violence, and the policymakers that exclude workers from protections when they're in industries that are disproportionately represented by women and immigrants. And those were the victims that we saw in the attacks.
I got a pop quiz for you. What other national politician, well known in this area, endorsed the union drive?
Somebody that you would least expect.
The prediction is that this bill is going to cut child poverty in half, not just in Ohio, but across the whole nation.
I don't think it's just people telling you if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I think it's people arguing about how true that is.
Women speak a universal language of silence. We can look at folks and stop them dead in their tracks. Because they know the most dangerous thing in the world is a quiet woman who is sitting there, but she's smiling.
As I proceed in my career and have the sense of myself as part of this continuum of labor archivists and librarians, we know there aren't that many of us.
I've got a brain, I've got talent, as much as the boss has too. And though I don't earn as much money, I deserve respect for what I can do.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, labor reacts to the murders of Asian women workers in Atlanta. An unlikely union supporter surfaces in Florida. How the American Rescue Plan will cut child poverty, and is pulling yourself up by your bootstraps a myth or reality? We've got reports from Your Rights at Work, We Educate Miami, America's Workforce Radio, and The Rick Smith Show. We continue our Women's History Month focus with reports from El Desfio and Tales from the Reuther Archives, and a performance of Uppercase Woman on Labor History Today. I'm Chris Garlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
This is a public service announcement with guitar!
Hey folks, it's Chris Garlock at Your Rights at Work, and Ed Smith is here. And Ed, we always play that song, and I don't know when it's been more appropriate than this week. It's a very tough week. And
yeah, just unbelievable what we see happening. And for those of you that just heard the news, that's I think what Chris is referring to. And it seems every week some other bomb is dropped, and unfortunately, that's what we're seeing in Atlanta. It's great to see some of the reactions from the NBA. LeBron James did post some stuff, and the level of support is out there. It's just unfortunate that there's too many people that do not care about people that don't look like them, unfortunately. But happy St. Day after St. Patty's Day, and we're looking forward to a great show anyway.
Absolutely. 202-588-0893. As always, if you've got questions about your rights on the job, you want to join the conversation. Our first guest today is Virginia Rodino. She's the Maryland coordinator for the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance, also known as APALA. She's also the national convener of United Against Hate. Virginia, thanks so much for taking time to be with us. And I'd love to just get your thoughts. I know APALA put out a statement on this yesterday, but just your thoughts, where are you at?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on this show, Chris. It was a very emotional day for those of us in the AAPI community yesterday, but I think the important element we've seen born out of the incredible demonstrations galvanizing around the movement for Black Lives last summer is like the multiracial, multi-ethnic composition of our entire movement right now. So it was that foundation of solidarity that I know the Asian American and Pacific Islander, the AAPI community, can find support and solace in this time. And I want to thank my beautiful friends, Reverend Kobe Little, the president of the NAACP Baltimore, and Zainab Chowdhury, the Maryland director for the Council on American Islamic Relations, for reaching out to me and Maryland APALA to extend their warmest solidarity. And it's that kind of solidarity that will help, you know, pull us through, because there are so many communities that are targeted by white supremacists. And it's just by sticking together that we'll see each other through this.
Virginia, the folks that were killed, almost all of obviously women, there were workers. And I'd really like to go into this a little bit in terms of the kind of workers they are and how this really just sort of seems to really hit home for the movement. I saw an outpouring of just his posts and social media, emails that I was getting from across the labor movement. This really strikes home, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to refer to the statement that Apollo National put out, that it's the misogyny and white supremacy that both empower white nationalists to these acts of violence, and the policymakers that exclude workers from protections when they're in industries that are disproportionately represented by women and immigrants. And those were the victims that we saw in the attacks. These are women, Asian women of color, that just don't have worker protections and are trying to just provide a decent life for themselves. So it was just this confluence, this ugly confluence of both sexism and racism that we saw rear its ugly head.
Ed, how do we get out of this box? And how do we convince some of these people that what they're doing is wrong and they just got to, how do we stop it?
Thanks, Ed.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think the answer is simple in terms of collectively standing together and building solidarity among us. But that project is so long term and we need to sustain it over years and years. We're fighting systemic racism. We're fighting systemic economic injustice. And to overturn those huge boulders in front of us, it's going to take the whole of all workers everywhere to really just band together to fight that and create systems that will treat us more equally and more just. As you're pointing out, the links to racial injustice are definitely just so closely aligned and interwoven with economic injustice in the workplace. And so the pandemic, if folks didn't know it before, then the pandemic ripped the blinders off of every country in terms of who was being hit in disproportionate amounts in terms of particularly women of color with unemployment during the pandemic, in terms of the communities of color who were dying disproportionately from the pandemic, and just every step of the way in terms of dealing with the pandemic. We see it with environmental injustice. We see it with every issue that our society faces. And really, it's just going to take all of us, no matter what color or creed or generation we're coming from, to stick together. And I think it starts in our workplaces. It starts in our communities, where we just link arms and say, your fight is my fight. And so that's what we're seeing, too, again, in response to the hate crimes that happened in Atlanta, where so many different communities are coming out and saying, you're not standing alone. The AAPI community has support. And so that's the way to defeat this. Taryn Gelling, who is an Apollo member, she's the director of civic and community engagement at IBEW. She was inspired by all the women in her life as she wrote this, and her song Spirit just really takes on very special power and meaning after these recent acts in Georgia.
Thanks again, Virginia. Let's hear from Taryn.
When you feel the of a burden sigh, when there's no escape but to weep and cry, in the face of hurt, in the face of pain, when loss reveals a truth remains, song is spirit and spirit is breath, between notes when we pause in breath, spirit can rest. Rhythm is a bass drum beating through veins, just as the tide waxes and wanes. Song is spirit, spirit is breath, when we pause in breath, spirit can rest. When you feel the weight of a burden inside, when there's no escape but to weep and cry, in the face of hurt, in the face of pain, when loss reveals, a truth remains. Song is spirit.
Educate Miami, the podcast from the United Teachers of Dade, Florida, with a pop quiz.
Let's see if you guys are paying attention. I got a pop quiz for you. What other national politician, well known in this area, endorsed the union drive? Oh, this week we were happily surprised when workers received another solidarity message from a politician well known to our listeners. Can you guess who it was?
Well known to our listeners. I think if I answered, I would be cheating because I did a little research on this.
Okay, so
it's somebody that you would least expect. Because if in the USA Today on Saturday, this well-known elected wrote, "What our nation desperately needs is not more oligopolies like Amazon or hostile relationships. What we need is a more productive relationship between labor and management." Sounds like Bernie Sanders, right? Nope, not Bernie. I'll provide you with another hint. The person further wrote, "One of my earliest political memories was marching the picket line with my dad in a culinary workers' union strike when he worked as a hotel bartender, and the lesson I took from it, all workers deserve respect. He has stuck with me all throughout my career." Could it be a progressive rookie congresswoman known as the Squad or AOC? I don't think so. I think you're getting cold. I think if I went like this forever, you would never figure out who this is.
They're never going to guess it. They're never going to guess it.
Because this is a person who actually lives the opposite of where he speaks.
Yes.
The person I'm talking to, ladies and gentlemen, is none other than our Florida U.S. Senator, Republican Senator, Marco Rubio.
No way.
So if you did not get the pop quiz correct, it is certainly understandable.
We need to know more about Marco Rubio's stance on and his labor record. And the Intelligencer reports that over the course of his career, the Florida lawmaker has backed the AFL-CIO's position in relevant Senate votes 8% of the time. Okay, less than 10% of the time. For the average Senate Republican, that figure is 17%. Rubio is a co-sponsor of the National Right to Work legislation, a policy that undermines organized labor by allowing workers to join a unionized workplace to enjoy the benefits of a collective bargaining agreement without paying dues to the union that negotiated it, which has the effect of encouraging other workers to skirt their dues, which then can drain a union of the funds it needs to survive. Rubio opposes the $15 minimum wage and supported all manner of anti-labor cabinet nominees during the Trump administration. Just last night, he criticized Joe Biden for including a bailout of the pensions of millions of Teamsters, carpenters, builders, and other unionized trades in the newly signed American Rescue Plan. Some might cynically suggest Rubio wants to beat up on Amazon because of a liberal bent of the Washington Post and curry favor with the Palm Beach resident fighting to occupy Mar-a-Lago since he was expelled from the White House. We could say that if Rubio was serious about respecting workers and have productive relationships between labor and management, he would find no better example than the productive working relationship between unionized frontline workers, including teachers and district staff, as well as unionized medical staff like nurses, interns, and doctors in many places around the country, unionized transportation and public safety workers. Educators have been simultaneously providing science-driven health education, and many have been working face-to-face with our students since October of 2020, after the state mandated all public schools in the state to return to face-to-face instruction. These unionized segments of the workforce have been extremely cooperative and collaborative in getting through this pandemic. So you might think that the U.S. Senator Rubio would write an op-ed directed at his party mates in Tallahassee, suggesting them show respect for workers and more productive relationships with the unions that have steadfastly demonstrated good faith in working with our children, our communities, as our educators have. We agree that Amazon workers deserve the right to choose for themselves and appreciate that Senator Rubio wrote those lines. However, if Senator Rubio is going to be sincere in his support for collaborative and cooperative labor relationships, he would oppose overt union-busting legislation being advanced in Tallahassee for state workers and particularly educators. So shame on you, Marco Rubio, for being a sellout and then trying to flip the script and act like he, you know, thinks differently about working people.
Thank you for listening to our program today. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday at 4:30 p.m. for We Educate Miami. To our UTD members, thank you for your hard work. United Teachers of Dade is a union of professionals who work to advance the cause of public education. We educate students, empower our members, and work with parents and the community to build a stronger Miami.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And we're back. It's America's Workforce. Don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook, AWF Union Podcast, and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. Just want to mention this before we get to Melissa Cropper on behalf of the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Shortly after Democrats in Congress passed President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief legislation, a Republican senator was already trying to take some credit for the bill, even though he and every single other Republican voted against it. I'm talking about Senator Roger Wicker, a Republican out of Mississippi. He tweeted last week that independent restaurant operators are going to get billions of dollars coming to their rescue thanks to the COVID relief bill. The House passed the relief legislation Wednesday on a vote of 220 to 211. One Democrat, Maine Representative Jared Golden, voted with every single Republican in voting no. And the polling has shown people love this. They're going to get some nice checks here. It's going to cut down child poverty. It goes on and on. Now, when reporters on the Hill asked Wicker about his tweet and the fact that he also voted against the bill, he said it was a stupid question. This is his response. One good provision in a $1.9 trillion bill doesn't mean I have to vote for the whole thing. I could hear Melissa laughing in the background. You can't make this stuff up, huh, Melissa?
No, you can't.
It's good for some people in my district, but I didn't vote for it.
Right.
All right. Let's talk about what's in the plan here for the state of Ohio. And obviously, you're president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers. We appreciate your sponsorship, and you had an opportunity. This bill is pretty lengthy. I think it's 600 plus pages, and it helps out so many causes here. And it's funny, too, because the Republicans are saying only 9% is for COVID relief, for vaccinations. Yeah, but you know what? Because of the pandemic, a lot of people are hurting in various ways. And this is a prime example. So if you can whittle this down to the state of Ohio, what are we going to get here, Melissa?
Sure. I mean, for the state of Ohio alone, just to give you a few numbers, there'll be 5,373,432 people who are going to get that direct check to them. So yeah, that's a significant amount of the population in Ohio, obviously. It's almost half of the population in Ohio. $11.2 billion in state and local aid. That's for the vaccine distribution, but also that's to help prevent essential workers who have been so critical to us for the past year to keep them employed, to keep them, you know, keep them from being laid off as we move forward. $4.71 billion for our schools. Of course, that's the one that's highly important to our membership here at OFT, but to help us continue to reopen schools, which we're mostly reopened now, but also to help with all the health and safety things that are needed and providing the needs that children have coming out of post-pandemic. So this is really huge for our schools and our communities. There would be 2,372,000 children, and that includes 691,000 workers who are going to benefit from the earned income tax expansion. So, I mean, these numbers are hard to wrap our heads around sometimes, but the prediction is that this bill is going to cut child poverty in half, not just in Ohio, but across the whole nation. And you and I have talked so many times about the non-academic barriers to children's learning. When we take mm-hmm. care of children's needs in communities like this, when there's things in here for rental assistance and food assistance and things like that, that all goes to help our children, which helps them perform better in school, which obviously down the road provides better outcomes. So we're absolutely thrilled by the passing of this bill.
Do you hear anything about when this is going to filter in to the states, or is it going to take weeks, months, right away? What's the buzz on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think the direct checks are scheduled to come out soon. I'm not real sure about how the rest of the money filters down. We're still looking into that. You know, that the state of Ohio is still figuring out how to give out the last round of COVID relief money for schools. So I think it's going to be a while before this actually happens, but they also have a while to actually spend the money. I don't think the money has to be spent until 2023. So this provides for some long-term solutions for our schools. It's not just like we're going to have this infusion of school of money for the next few months and then it's gone. We have some money to make some plans that are going to carry us forward.
Gotcha. Thank you so much for the update. Melissa Cropper, president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oft-aft.org. We'll talk to you next month, okay?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we hear it all the time that you just got to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. You work hard, play by the rules, you'll get ahead. Just, you didn't work hard enough if you didn't. And this idea that we've been ingrained in our minds, and I'm guilty of it as well. This idea that, you know, you just got to work harder. But I have a new book, What We Mean by the American Dream, Stories We Tell About Meritocracy. This is a fantastic book. I hope folks will take a look at. And I've got the author here with us, Doran Tazig, as a visiting assistant professor at Ursinus College, also the author of the great book, which we'll get links out for so people can take a look at. Doran, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
So there are tons of things that we tell ourselves about what the American dream is and how to achieve that. I'm curious, why did you take this topic on to write this book?
It's just everywhere. I don't think it's just people telling you if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I think it's people arguing about how true that is. People are constantly talking about this. I think, you know, trying to figure out when it's true, where it's true, who has achieved things, who deserves what they have. I think it's a real, like, serious American preoccupation. And I think people don't actually that frequently just ask people, how did you get where you are and do you feel like you deserve it?
That's an excellent question. And I on this program, I talk about how I got where I am all the time. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I now live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers. I give that credit because, one, I do work really hard. But two, and more importantly, I'm a white guy, and I was a member of a labor union for 33 years. All the work that I did was compensated at a reasonable rate. There's a lot to this that I know the simple answer is I did it myself because I'm wonderful.
Yeah. An interesting thing I noticed when I, you know, this book is based on interviews I did with people about this question, people from a lot of different walks of life. And an interesting thing I think I noticed is when you ask regular people, how did you get to where you are? And they tell you a story, they tend to tell a complicated story like what you just did, right? People understand that there are external factors that matter in their lives. And so people will talk about, my parents taught me, you know, I had such and such good parents, or somebody gave me this car, or I had this lucky break, or I had a great mentor. People are aware that these things matter. It seems not to register in our politics as much as I'd like, and I think as much as a lot of us would like, this level that people understand our individual lives on, you know, understanding these other things matter. I think it needs to be reflected in our politics more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it comes down to you were in the right spot at the right time sometimes. So from a policy standpoint, because we do like to believe that, you know, we made it on our own. We do like to believe that we're, you know, smarter or better or more deserving. You know, especially I have some religious friends who believe that their success is ordained by God. And you do talk about that in your book a little bit. Because we do want to try and separate ourselves from everyone else, when in fact we're no better or no worse than anybody else.
So you're asking about like from a policy standpoint? Right. Yeah, I mean, look, leveling the playing field is really important. But in addition to that, it's really important to improve people's quality of life regardless of what's happening on the playing field, right? So because the playing field is never going to be perfectly level, because even if, and it would be great if we could deal with like all of these various, you know, structural inequities, but there's still going to be health issues. There's still going to be lucky breaks. There's still going to be right place, right time. And if the punishment for ending up on the wrong side of those is as dramatic as it is in America today, I don't think that's a healthy society.
So what are you hoping comes out of this book? I mean, I hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get the links out. What are you hoping people will take from it?
I hope that we can move past that conversation about meritocracy that says either we're already in one or we're going to fix the couple of things that are wrong and then we'll be in one. I hope people realize that the way we think about our lives already, we can think about society that way. I want people to see that most Americans already see that, and that maybe we can pursue a policy that reflects that.
Right. You know, because you know, I'm in this moment where I'm now thinking of all the email I'm going to get from my conservative listeners who are saying, well, are you talking about socialism? All of us are going to be equal and all that. We're not talking about that, right?
No, I'm not talking about that. I think that there are some really important principles that are part of meritocracy that it would be silly to get rid of. The idea that your birth shouldn't determine your station in life. That's like a meritocratic idea. And the idea that like the kid with the strong arm should play quarterback is a natural meritocratic idea. There's going to be some degree of sorting. I want the stakes of sorting to be lower, both in terms of economic rewards and in terms of like the dignity and the status that comes with success. Because of all these factors we're talking about, the good that go into success, that are just a bit more arbitrary in a lot of cases than we acknowledge.
I like the book. I hope people will take a look at it, What We Mean by the American Dream, written by Doran Tausig. We'll get links out so people can pick this up. Doran, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks so much, Rick. Take care.
Good talking with you. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to El Desvío. Many roads, one destination. Encountering challenges, making decisions, confronting struggles, and better understanding the reasons for polarizing positions are but a part of being engaged in our nation's ability to discuss and advance towards a more inclusive and fair society. However, there is no set formula to achieve these objectives. El Desvío presents listeners with 30 minutes of thought-provoking discussions on relevant issues we face as a nation.
Bueno, mi gente. Welcome back to El Desvío, many roads, one destination. Today we have a special episode titled, The Sazón, the Labor Movement, a recipe for advancing and leading within the labor movement. March is Women's History Month, a special time that we set aside to dedicate to the accomplishments and contributions, the roles that women play within the labor movement, and of course, the issues that affect them.
Jose, this is definitely a very exciting and important episode. Today, we will hear from Cloyola Brown, who is the president of the A. Philip Randolph Institute, APRI, and she was also recently appointed as the AFL-CIO's Civil, Human, and Women's Rights Director. Congratulations, Cloyola. And LACLA's first woman national president, Yanira Merino.
When you're talking about being workers and being women, especially in the last year of the pandemic, I think women have shown majestic skills in being able to manage it all, whether you're a mom at home with kids or you're at work managing staff or taking care of parents and siblings that get COVID and all the things that we've had to struggle this year. Wonder Women is not just a cliche. Working hard is never one of those things that we don't do. House in order, absolutely. I want to invite, I would say Cloyola, if you can talk to us a little bit about this house in order, this labor movement, this working hard and being Wonder Woman in time of pandemic.
I started to laugh because like our houses at home, for many of us, there's always the task of making sure that everything gets put in an orderly fashion, which is totally different than house in order. We may get that once a month or every now and again. If we're really aggravated about something, I can clean the house when I'm mad. And it gets done really well then. And anybody in that house, you too, you know, right? You too,
yes. Yes.
Yeah, if that energy is flowing because someone has ticked you off the wrong way, everything gets done. And I think that Trump ticked us off the right way. And that in our own house of labor, we have been ticked off the right way from time to time. So women who are perceived to be shy, we're not shy, we're just strategizing, that's all. Waiting to be smart. Because anybody can get real mad and jump, but to get mad enough to do what you're talking about, Lucia, which is putting stuff in order, is what women do best, especially when we do it collectively. Because you guys were saying early on, we don't have capes that we can put on our magic lariat or any of that stuff that we can whip and make things cling and chang and run and all the rest of it. But I tell you what, we do have something that folks recognize no matter what color or what language we are. Women speak a universal language of silence. We can look at folks and stop them dead in their tracks. Because they know the most dangerous thing in the world is a quiet woman who is sitting there, but she's smiling. Okay.
And can I just say, Cloyola, that's a great segue for me, at least, to say how much I enjoyed meeting Yanira when I did a couple of years back, and that look said it all. I felt like a little kid just waiting for to be given direction and stride. And she just needed to look at me and say, you're gonna hear me out. And I'm like, absolutely. Anything you say. And it was more because I saw the conviction, the commitment. I saw like that strength in her desire to see things move in an order. And I'm sorry, Yanira, just to call you out on this one, that stare me down. I was feeling it penetrate. Oh, that was great.
I've seen that look.
Yes. And Yanira, when we all put our minds together and strategize and our, you know, wheels are turning, we don't need to say much. We know exactly where things need to be placed. And yet it's not easy. Even if we know in our hearts where things need to go, it is not easy. Yanira, how do you get us there? How have you through the movement gotten yourself there to a point where I can't even say what I'm saying?
Thank you. It's so nice to be with all my sisters here. Hey, look, it's about love at the end of the day. My mother brought us from a country the first time I was 14. She put me in a train from Guadalajara, Mexico to Tijuana. undocumented. My mother didn't have, I think, fifth grade education was the most that she had. But she had a vision that her family was going to survive no matter what, that passion. I don't want to say that she wasn't scared, because I'm sure she was. I was only 14. She was putting me in the train that was going to be almost a day and a half. But she had a vision for the future. And it's that love and it's that passion that really, that love that we have for our family, for our human fellows, whether they're women or men, that we know we want something better, if not for us, for those that we gave life. That love and that heart into achieving what is best for humankind, we base it in the closest people that we love. And I think in the labor movement, that's what it has become. When we meet new and younger generations that are trying to do, I'm sure that all of us run to enrich that experience, because we know that we were there once, but we also that we have to build from the future.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Y hasta la próxima.
That's it for now. Be sure to follow us at LACLA, that is LCLAA, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And visit our website, www.lacla.org. LACLA's El Desvío Podcast is a proud member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, the voice of working people. To learn more about issues that affect workers, visit laborradionetwork.org. This podcast was made possible by the support of the AFL-CIO and the Sí Podemos Fund, LACLA's national C4 organization.
Hello, and welcome to another Tales from the Reuther, a podcast from the Walter P. Reuther Library at Wayne State University in the middle of the biggest hearted city ever, Detroit, Michigan. I am Dan Galadner, your host today, with the raddest of co-producers, Troy Eller English. What's shaking, English?
Not much for the past year.
It's been a fun year, hasn't it?
That's one way to put it, yes.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, there's so many things to say about this year. And we're coming across the 1 year. We are on the 1 year anniversary of when the state of Michigan started shutting down with the spread of COVID-19. It was going on. We were like throwing everything in a box and heading home and not knowing if we were going to be back in a couple weeks or a month. And all the while, we had a new director starting at the Reuther Library. Alika Jarasi she never made it into the building to start her new gig. She sent us an email saying hi and basically, hold on, folks. We don't know what's going on. We were all excited to get going, rolling in 2020 with a new director. We had all these grand ideas, and then bam, pandemic hits. Doors slam shut and we can't come in. But folks, as you are aware, the Reuther Library never stopped. Podcasts were being recorded. Troy and I figured it out. Collections were made available online, and we managed to figure out how to help researchers, all from the leadership of our new director. So this podcast is on the anniversary of when she started. So we thought this would be a good idea to have a cool conversation with her. So Alika, thank you for joining us on our podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan and Troy, for inviting me. I'm so pleased to be joining you for Tales from the Reuther Library.
I know. It is an amazing podcast. We have millions of listeners, and it keeps growing. The Reuther? You're coming from Cornell. You're coming from New York State. Come to Detroit and hang out in the Reuther? I know the search committee asked this probably last year.
Yeah. My answer is, of course, the Reuther. Of course, the true. Reuther. Yeah. And when I look out back at some of my experiences that got me here, as I've shared, I'll recount, it could have been in some form the Reuther at an earlier stage if everything had lined up properly. A little bit farther down the line in my undergraduate career, I contemplated moving to Detroit and transferring to Wayne State, because as I thought about what library school might look like, I started looking at schools that had both labor studies and library science programs. And right, Wayne State is one of those very few places. And I actually came out here on a road trip that brought us through Canada. In my big old 1986 Chevrolet Caprice, just rattling around on the road, I came here in January and stayed downtown and went to this undergraduate fair to check things out. And there are a lot of other things going on in my life, and I decided to stay in New York State. It always stayed with me, even before I started formally working in libraries, that this was a place that married these two areas of inquiry that I was passionate about and somehow wanted to combine in my life. And as I proceeded in my career, I ended up working at the Tamament. That was my first labor archives job. I worked there as both in, as I was finishing up my library degree and then ended up proceeding elsewhere, and then ended up working at Cornell at the labor library. And obviously Ruther was one of the other major libraries and archives, our peer institution. And as I proceed in my career and have the sense of myself as part of this continuum of labor archivists and librarians, we know there aren't that many of us, especially compared to, you know, our perceived heyday of a few decades ago. So it was always very closely attuned to what Ruther was doing. Even if I didn't know all of you directly, we certainly had plenty of people in common, many predecessors in common, and that worked closely together. And so by the time the position was posted and I became aware of it, it felt like a natural progression. And then, of course, when I came and met all of you, it's clicked. We've all been part of this same movement of documenters going back decades, trying to capture labor and social movements. So why Ruther? Why? Of course the Ruther. I'm so pleased to be here. So proud to be part of
it. We're glad to have you here as well. It is, yeah, it's the Ruther. When I was looking at grad school, I was interning at AFT, and they said, go to University of Maryland, because you can work at the Meany Center and do that. Or you go to Detroit, you go to Wayne State, you go to the Ruther Library. Mm-hmm. And that was just like, it's a no-brainer. I'll just go to I've never been to Detroit, so might as well, you know, I've been up and down the East Coast. Let's check out the Midwest. And yeah, it's the Ruther. We're a fun place.
Great place.
And everybody should come visit once we are allowed to. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed the conversation. And I know our millions of listeners will love listening to our new director of the Ruther Library.
Thank you so much. It was such a nice opportunity to get to introduce myself, say hello. And I'm looking forward to seeing what the next year or two brings and how we continue to document it at Ruther.
This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl.
Hey folks, on this week's Labor History Today.
I want to see my name in uppercase letters. No little alphabet will do, because though I'm a secretary, I'm an uppercase person too.
Confidential Administrative Assistant Janine Hightower performs Uppercase Woman. I'm Chris Garla, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. Here's the show.
But this is a man.
This is Elise Bryant, president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women. Years ago, when I worked in the office as a secretary, the common practice was to type up the letter, and at the bottom of the letter, I would put the initials of my supervisor, the person who wrote the letter, and my initials as the person who typed the letter. I don't know if this still goes on today, but I suspect it does, even with computers. But why we did it that way, I'm not sure. But here's what one secretary wrote about this practice.
I want to see my name in uppercase letters. No little alphabet will do, because though I'm a secretary, I'm an uppercase person too. I've got a brain, I've got talent, as much as the boss has too. And though I don't earn as much money, I deserve respect for what I can do. I don't want my name in lowercase letters on those letters I type for you. I deserve to be treated as an equal, because Mr. Boss, I'm as good as you. So I'll put my name in uppercase letters on those letters I type for you. Because though I'm a secretary, I'm an uppercase woman too.
That was Uppercase Woman, a poem by Ellen Elizabeth Payne. It was published in the August 1990 edition of the British Columbia Government and Service Employees Union, BCGEU, Component 12 Administrative Services Newsletter. The BCGEU is a trade union in British Columbia, Canada, which represents over 80,000 members. The union employs over 200 servicing and administrative staff in 12 area offices across the province and at their head office. Uppercase Woman was read for us by Janine Hightower, a confidential administrative assistant in the Office of the Secretary Treasurer at the National Headquarters of the American Federation of Teachers in Washington, D.C. Janine is a former member of Local 2 of the Office and Professional Employees International Union, or OPEIU. Janine said this, "The poem got me all fired up because I am a secretary," Janine told Labor History Today. "And it is part of AFT's letter templates that upper and lowercase initials be added to the letters just like the poem." She went on to say, "I actually have thought about this concept way back in the day, but I turned the lowercase letter thing around in my mind to feel that the lowercase letters will identify who the assistant is, so I'll know whom to ask about anything related to the boss, because those lowercase letters are the ones who have their fingers on the pulse of the office of department." Janine added, in all capital letters, "Loving this poem!" For Labor History Today, this is Elise Bryant. Happy Women's History Month.
That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 Labor Radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon and Chris Banger-Drowns, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LaborRadioNet. Find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Check out our live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio podcast show.